Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Reviews, designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one, what was the name of the musical based on the real-life story of the Von Trapp family singers that opened on Broadway on this day back in 1959? Hint, these singers from the hillsides of Austria were one of the world's best-known concert groups in the era immediately preceding World War II. So, what's the name of the 1959 Broadway musical based on their life story? And question number two, it was on this day back in 1956 that who appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show and performed his hit, Blueberry Hill? Hint, here's a snippet from this very 1956 recording.
Found my thrill on Blueberry Hill. On Blueberry Hill, when I found you.
Sound familiar? Who is this singer? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program.
It lingered until my dream came from.
Today's transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of November the 16th. Well, it was on this day, back in 1974, that ABBA began their first tour of Europe. It was also their first tour outside of Sweden, 1974 today. And it was 19 years ago today, 1997, that John Denver's last recording, the Unplugged Collection, was released in the U.S., 1997.
Is there one trouble so these hands of mine could hold? Who's gonna miss me when I'm gone? Who's gonna wanna follow in my footsteps maybe? Who's gonna miss me when I'm gone?
Loretta Lynn's Who's Gonna Miss Me introduces our country music news. It's an article written by David Cantwell, published on the 16th of October, 2018 in the New Yorker magazine, entitled Loretta Lynn's New Album and the Trail She Blazed in Country Music. Loretta Lynn once dreamed of putting together an all-woman backing band called the Lynettes, but it never happened. It was that old double standard again, she explains in Coal Miner's Daughter, the memoir published in 1976 that she named after her signature song. People started saying you can't have a traveling girl band. If you had one incident, people would start gossiping about it, she adds. But an all-girl band would have been fantastic. Instead, she hired an all-male band and called them the Coal Miners. Although Lynn routinely rejects the label of feminist, the songs that she's written or chosen for herself have repeatedly blasted misogynistic attitudes that excuse or idealize male misbehavior. The most emblematic example of this became her first number one hit in 1966, the punchy and pissed Don't Come Home A-Drinkin' With Lovin' On Your Mind. Lynn includes a new version of Don't Come Home A-Drinkin' on her new album, Wouldn't It Be Great, the 41st studio album of her career. The new version is less sprightly. It feels weightier, more grounded. It's as though Lynn, who is 86, has swapped out her trademark spunk and sass for something wearier. Just how many times is she going to have to explain this? Thanks to the memoir and the film adaptation of it starring Sissy Spacek from 1980, Lynn's story is well known. She grew up poor in Appalachian Kentucky to a coal mining dad who she adored. When she was 15, she married a boy from a nearby holler. Lynn became a mother of four by the age that most girls are graduating from high school. In Nashville, Lynn was befriended and mentored by Patsy Cline, who at the time was the most successful woman in country music. This version of the Loretta Lynn story tends to present the singer as a woman in a man's world, mostly guided by and reacting to the men around her. But it wasn't just Cline. The key figures in Lynn's early artistic development were just as often women as they were men. Lynn's most important vocal inspiration was Kitty Wells, who, before Cline came along, was the only woman in country history to consistently score major solo hits. Lynn's string of early 60s hits, as well as contemporaneous chart runs from Skeeter Davis and from Cline, launched a golden age for women on country radio, or what passed for one, after years when they barely registered. The arrival of other performers, such as Dottie West, accompanied soon enough by the rise of the country superstars Tammy Wynette and Dolly Parton, seemed at the time to represent a seismic shift towards gender parity. A country radio dialogue between men and women, meeting on equal terms and tackling the domestic issues that mattered to them most, seemed surely just around the corner. It hasn't played out that way. For a time, it seemed as though Wouldn't It Be Great wouldn't be released. Lynn suffered a stroke in the spring of 2017, and she decided to hold the album's release until she had recovered enough to promote it. It fractured hip extended the delay, and Lynn's health remains a concern. On October 17th, Lynn received the Artist of the Lifetime Award on CMT. Fetting Lynn, the woman who did the most to break down doors for women in country, is a savvy gesture, but also a perfectly frustrating reminder that more than half a century after her arrival on the charts, women are as locked out of the format as they have been in decades. But they are not, thank goodness, locked out of the genre, and a good part of the thanks of that goes to Lynn. It's probably impossible to fast any gesture that could adequately acknowledge her legacy. But wouldn't it be great, as Lynn stood at the microphone accepting her award by the female musicians whom she's inspired through the years gathered behind her, this crowd of country women would stretch on and on until finally we see Tammy and Dolly there too. Picture all those women standing behind Lynn, standing there because of her, singing and playing in her footsteps. Call them the Lynettes.
Fingers bleed to complain, there was no need. She'd smile in mommy's understanding way.
Mahler's Eighth Symphony Finale introduces our classical music news. It's an article entitled, A Concert Goer rustled a bag of gum during a Mahler symphony, a violent attack ensued. This is published in the Washington Post on the 22nd of October 2018 by Isaac Stanley Becker. It is said to represent the composer's love letter to his new bride, and, like love, the adagietto transport those who receive it, its atmospheric notes offering release from the grim foreboding and frenetic outburst of the earlier movements of Gustav Mahler's Fifth Symphony. But worldly concerns have a way of intruding. An iPhone light, a candy wrapper, one too many trips to the restroom, the rustling of a gum wrapper at the performance of the symphony last week in the Swedish city of Malmö brought a section of the audience back down to earth, and several concert-goers to blows. Mahler's late romantic epic became the occasion for an epic clash over candy, as Andris Nelsons, an eminent Latvian conductor, coaxed the quiet notes from the string section of the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. A woman in the balcony rustled a bag of gum. Young man sitting next to her glared a few times, and then lost his patience. He snatched the bag from her and threw it onto the floor. Witnesses told the daily newspaper that the woman sat stoically through the rest of the adagietto, which typically lasts about 10 minutes. Very slow, Mahler instituted in the score, and the vigorous and triumphant finale. The symphony composed in 1901 has been described as a large-scale journey similar to climbing Mount Everest. Leonard Bernstein conducted the adagietto at the funeral to Robert F. Kennedy in 1968. But as the concert hall vibrated with the final resounding notes, and as applause rang out, she exacted her revenge. The gum rustler turned to her neighbor and uttered something, and then proceeded to smack him in the face, knocking off his glasses. The woman's male companion then grabbed the man by the shirt, began to punch him, as the seizer of the gum sought to defend himself. "It was very unpleasant, actually. I've never seen anything like it," said Olaf Johnson, who was sitting in the row behind the brawling patrons. He described the salvo from the woman and her ally as a violent attack. At one point, as the tension seemed to ease, the woman's companion walked toward the younger man as if to converse with him, but then punched him in the stomach. Other patrons intervened, establishing a ceasefire after news of the fracas appeared. The concert venue publicized a list of reminders about etiquette. The announcement took a genial tone. "While it is wonderful to sit at a hockey or football match and drink a beer or coffee and eat little snacks," it cautioned, "this behavior doesn't suit a concert hall with world-class acoustics." A spokeswoman for the venue said the venue had no plans to play host to other high-risk concerts except possibly Verdi's Requiem next month. "Extremely powerful. Will awaken strong feelings," she said. Kelly performing Singing in the Rain from the movie of the same name introduces our jazz, blues, and Broadway music news. It's an article entitled, "Wanna Know Lin-Manuel Miranda's 5 Favorite Musicals?" And this is published on the 3rd of November 2018 by Mary Ann Butler in BleedingCool.com. We really enjoy finding out what creative personalities are drawn to, their favorite list of things and inspirations. Just this week, Lin-Manuel Miranda revealed a list of his 5 favorite musicals, as well as some pretty great stories as to why. In an interview with the New York Times, in no particular order, the In the Heights and Hamilton creator spoke about what musicals mean to him and why he loves them. There are some people who say, I don't really like musicals. That means that music is very divorced from their life experience, and they're not willing to let music bleed into everyday speech or an everyday moment. Growing up in a Latino household, it's the most natural thing in the world for music to bubble over into conversation. Considering my dad's love for Debbie Reynolds, it's strange that Singing in the Rain didn't play more often in my house, but I didn't really appreciate it until I was older. It is a perfect movie, every number in it kind of glorious. What I love about both these movies is that I don't think you could make them today because we don't make stars like that anymore. The long takes of Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire, respectively. Donald O'Connor in the number Make 'em Laugh. I can watch that scene a million times, and it shouldn't still make me laugh, but it does. Lots of times you watch and wonder that it even exists. Another classic, 1953's The Bandwagon. I joke to people the last scene is how I would like the last scene of my life to go. It's Fred Astaire. He's worked on this musical out of town, and he thinks they've got a big hit, and nobody's celebrating. So he sings in a little funk, I guess I'll have to find my way. And then he goes into the room, and everybody he loves is in one room, and they all sing, for he's a jolly good fellow. And then his best friends show up, and then they all sing, That's Entertainment. I mean, what a way to go. It's Michael Jackson's Smooth Criminal video, entirely taken from the sequence at the end of that film. The suit, the dance. You see what an influence Fred Astaire was on one of our biggest heroes growing up. 2002's Chicago gets a slot, too. What I always say about Rob Marshall is he should have been born in the MGM era, and I think he'd be the first to admit that, too. He's kind of the closest director we have in terms of taking today's stars and crafting incredible musicals with them. Cell Block Tango is about as thrilling a piece of musical theater movie-making as exists, and it could sit alongside any of those old movies from that era, and yet what amazes me about it is the way he frames the story, and that we very firmly go into people's heads, and we have license to do whatever we want once we're in there. And it's so clear. In a lot of bad movie musicals, the editing is such that you can't even tell who is dancing or what's going on. And Rob uses editing to do the opposite. He uses editing to illuminate the gifts of the people on screen, and it's really awesome. Unsurprisingly, the animated classic The Little Mermaid is on the list. Miranda is working on the new live-action version for Disney. My own contributions to the musicals in the VHS player at home really begin with The Little Mermaid. I don't know why I loved it so much, but it really grabbed a hold of me. I was obsessed with it. I was in about the fourth grade when it came out. And one we weren't expecting, Jim Henson's Labyrinth, starring David Bowie. I don't think people would think of that as a movie musical, but it is totally a David Bowie movie musical. Unless you saw it as a child, you're like, what is going on here? Who greenlit this very strange movie? And while it's a kid's movie, there's really dark, scary stuff. But it was a huge movie for me growing up. Article skips down and ends with this. For my generation, our first experience with David Bowie was as a movie musical villain. I'm sure Labyrinth doesn't make everyone's list top 10 musicals, but it wields a strange power in my life and in our house growing up. And in music research and technology, I only listen to classic rock and R&B oldies. Am I normal? Answer yes. This is written in AARP, the magazine, November 2018, by Celine Yeager. The music that captured your heart as a teenager will likely be your first love forever, according to a New York Times analysis of data from the Spotify streaming music service. The songs streamed the most are often those that came out when they were 13 or 14 years old. But it's also worth noting that a new normal is starting to emerge thanks to the Internet. It's easier than ever to discover new music in the genres you enjoy, says Jeremy Wallach, a professor of popular culture at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. People in their post-retirement years now make up a significant portion of the audience for live music, and they have shown a willingness to give newer artists a try. Barbra Streisand performing here with John Mayer, Come Rain or Come Shine, introduces our pop music news. It's an article from the November 9, 2018 issue of Entertainment Weekly that introduces Streisand's new album, Walls. Apparently all it takes to get Babs to write new music is an unhinged republic. Walls, her first album of mostly original songs since 2005, is a somber but spirited record of unbridled Streisand rage with obvious political targets. Who could Don't Lie to Me be about? And plenty of power ballads worth screaming along with in your car.
You're gonna love me.
I'm gonna love you.
Like nobody's loved me.
Like nobody's loved you.
Come rain or come shine.
I know it may seem a bit early, but with the annual Christmas parade in downtown Raleigh this weekend, we have this local music news announcement by the North Carolina Symphony. The Holiday Pops Extravaganza is Friday, November 23rd at 7:30 p.m. and Saturday, November 24th at 3 p.m. in My Mandy Concert Hall, Raleigh. Wesley Schultz conducting. Holiday Pops returns bigger and better than ever, featuring seasonal favorites, plus a sing-along, Falling Snow, and a chorus line of Dancing Santas. Visit Santa in the lobby starting 1 hour before the concert. Go to ncsymphony.org or phone 919-733-2750 for additional details and tickets. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our second question, it was on this day back in 1956 that Who appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show and performed his hit Blueberry Hill. And I played a snippet of this singer performing that 1956 song as a hint. Correct answer, Fats Domino. As noted in songfacts.com, this was written for the 1940 Western, The Singing Hill. The song was used in the movie where it was heard for the first time, performed by Gene Autry. Many artists recorded this before Domino, mostly orchestras. In 1940, it was a number two U.S. hit for Glenn Miller. That same year, Gene Krupa and Kay Kaiser recorded it with their orchestras. Louis Armstrong did the song in 1949. Other artists to cover the song include Elvis Presley, the Beach Boys, and Andy Williams. Fats Domino, who knew the song through Louis Armstrong's 1949 version, recorded this at a session in which he ran out of material to tape. Domino insisted on recording the song over the vehement objections of producer-arranger Dave Bartholomew, who felt the song had been done too many times already. Domino came up with the definitive version, though, featuring his famous piano triplets and sly Cajun accent. Larry Stock, who wrote the lyrics, recalled that one important publisher turned down Blueberry Hill because he claimed blueberries don't grow on hills. I assured him I had picked them on hills as a boy, but nothing doing. In 2010, at an event, we had Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin perform this song. Videos of his performance quickly went viral worldwide. Putin's spokesman said the former KGB chief learned the lyrics to the song as part of his English language studies. And the answer to our first question, what was the name of the musical based on the real-life story of the Von Trapp family singers that opened on Broadway on this very day back in 1959? Hint, these singers from the hillsides of Austria were one of the world's best-known concert groups in the era immediately preceding World War II. Correct answer is The Sound of Music. As noted in Mashable.com, the film, starring Julie Andrews as the governess, was an adaptation of the 1959 Rodgers and Hammerstein musical of the same name, which itself was based on Maria von Trapp's book, The Story of the Trapp Family Singers. Released in 1965, The Sound of Music is the fifth highest-grossing film of all time. It was so popular that it ran an unbroken release at cinemas worldwide for 4.5 years. The core of the film was true. A 19-year-old Maria von Trapp had indeed been in training to become a nun in the Salzburg Abbey. The abbess sent her to be a tutor for the children of widowed naval commander George von Trapp. The family became well known as the von Trapp Family Choir and left their homeland around the time of the German annexation of Austria. So let's close out today's program with the Rodgers and Hammerstein song from that musical about the small Austrian flower that has come to symbolize standing up to large injustices, Edelweiss. We've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.